Welcome to Covenant Presbyterian Church in West Des Moines, Iowa. This educational offering is part of our mission to bless our neighbors to the glory of God. We hope it blesses you.
All right, so I'm going to enforce the 9 o'clock start just because I've got lots of little videos to throw at you.
I want to just start by asking everyone in the audience here a question. How many of you are completely comfortable with calling yourselves a leader? See, I've asked that question all the way across the country, and everywhere I ask it, no matter where, there's always a huge portion of the audience that won't put up their hand. And I've come to realize that we have made leadership into something bigger than us. We made it into something beyond us. We made it about changing the world. And we've taken this title of leader, and we treat it as if it's something that one day we're going to deserve. But to give it to ourselves right now means a level of arrogance or cockiness that we're not comfortable with. And I worry sometimes that we spend so much time celebrating amazing things that hardly anybody can do, that we've convinced ourselves that those are the only things we're celebrating. And we start to devalue the things that we can do every day. And we start to take moments where we truly are a leader, and we don't let ourselves take credit for it, and we don't let ourselves feel good about it. And I've been lucky enough over the last 10 years to work with some amazing people who have helped me redefine leadership in a way that I think has made me happier. And with my short time today, I just want to share with you the one story that is probably most responsible for that redefinition. I went to a school on a little school called Mount Allison University in Sackville, New Brunswick. And on my last day there, a girl came up to me and she said, "I remember the first time that I met you." And then she told me a story that happened 4 years earlier. She said, "On my day before I started university, I was in the hotel room with my mom and my dad, and I was so scared and so convinced that I couldn't do this, that I wasn't ready for university, that I just burst into tears. And my mom and my dad were amazing. They were like, 'Look, we know you're scared, but let's just go tomorrow. Let's go to the first day. And if at any point you feel as if you can't do this, that's fine. Just tell us, we will take you home. We love you no matter what.'" And she said, "So I went the next day, and I was standing in line getting ready for registration, and I looked around and I just knew I couldn't do it. I knew I wasn't ready. I knew I had to quit." And she says, "I made that decision, and as soon as I made it, there was this incredible feeling of peace that came over me. And I turned to my mom and my dad to tell them that we needed to go home. And just at that moment, you came out of the student union building wearing the stupidest hat I have ever seen in my life. It was awesome. And you had a big sign promoting Shinerim, which is Students Fighting Cystic Fibrosis, a charity I've worked with for years. And you had a bucket full of lollipops. And you were walking along, and you were handing the lollipops out to people in line and talking about Shinerim. And all of a sudden, you got to me, and you just stopped, and you stared. It was creepy." This girl right here knows exactly what I'm talking about. "And then you looked at the guy next to me, and you smiled, and you reached in your bucket, you pulled out a lollipop, and you held it out to him. And you said, 'You need to give a lollipop to the beautiful woman standing next to you.' And she said, 'I have never seen anyone get more embarrassed faster in my life.' He turned beet red, and he wouldn't even look at me. He just kind of held the lollipop out like this. And I felt so bad for this dude that I took the lollipop. And as soon as I did, you got this incredibly severe look on your face, and you looked at my mom and my dad, and you said, 'Look at that. Look at that. First day away from home, and already she's taking candy from a stranger.'" And she said, "Everybody lost it. 20 feet in every direction, everyone started to howl. And I know this is cheesy, and I don't know why I'm telling you this, but in that moment when everyone was laughing, I knew that I shouldn't quit. I knew that I was where I was supposed to be, and I knew that I was home. And I haven't spoken to you once in the 4 years since that day, but I heard that you were leaving. And I had to come up and tell you that you've been an incredibly important person in my life, and I'm going to miss you. Good luck.' And she walks away, and I'm flattened. And she gets about 6 feet away, she turns around and smiles and goes, 'You should probably know this too. I'm still dating that guy 4 years later. A year and a half after I moved to Toronto, I got an invitation to their wedding. Here's the kicker: I don't remember that. I have no recollection of that moment, and I've searched my memory banks because that is funny and I should remember doing it, and I don't remember it. And that was such an eye-opening, transformative moment for me to think that maybe the biggest impact I'd ever had on anyone's life, a moment that had a woman walk up to a stranger 4 years later and say, 'You've been an incredibly important person in my life,' was a moment that I didn't even remember. How many of you guys have a lollipop moment, a moment where someone said something or did something that you feel fundamentally made your life better? All right, how many of you have told that person they did it? See, why not? We celebrate birthdays where all you have to do is not die for 365 days. And yet we let people who have made our lives better walk around without knowing it. And every single one of you, every single one of you has been the catalyst for a lollipop moment. You have made someone's life better by something that you said or that you did. And if you think you haven't, think about all the hands that didn't go back up when I asked that question. You're just one of the people who hasn't been told. But it is so scary to think of ourselves as that powerful. It can be frightening to think that we can matter that much to other people. Because as long as we make leadership something bigger than us, as long as we keep leadership something beyond us, as long as we make it about changing the world, we give ourselves an excuse not to expect it every day from ourselves and from each other. Marianne Williamson said, "Our greatest fear is not that we are inadequate. Our greatest fear is that we are powerful beyond measure. It is our light and not our darkness that frightens us." And my call to action today is that we need to get over that. We need to get over our fear of how extraordinarily powerful we can be in each other's lives. We need to get over it so we can move beyond it. And our little brothers and our little sisters, and one day our kids, or our kids right now, can watch us start to value the impact we can have on each other's lives more than money and power and titles and influence. We need to redefine leadership as being about lollipop moments. How many of them we create, how many of them we acknowledge, how many of them we pay forward, and how many of them we say thank you for. Because we've made leadership about changing the world, and there is no world. There's only 6 billion understandings of it. And if you change one person's understanding of it, one person's understanding of what they're capable of, one person's understanding of how much people care about them, one person's understanding of how powerful an agent for change they can be in this world, you've changed the whole thing. And if we can understand leadership like that, I think if we can redefine leadership like that, I think we can change everything. And it's a simple idea. But I don't think it's a small one. And I want to thank you all so much for letting me share it with you today.
I'm glad the words are there.
Yeah.
It's hard to put it.
So, Drew Dudley very quickly said that you're a leader. You make a difference in the world, and you may not even know it. Or you may not know the ways in which you make a difference in the world. And it's those little tiny moments that do it. So I want to talk about leadership today, because one of the questions as we were working with the ideas that mattered for us as people in the world. So the issues for faithful voters, the earlier issues that we've talked about, this is contemporary issues, right? One of the questions that came up was, well, how do I get involved? How do I make a difference on the issues that matter to me? And especially, how do I make a difference in the world and still keep my friends? Because there are people I care about in the world, and there are issues I care about in the world, and it can be hard to keep those lined up. It can be, particularly given the ways in which we've defined what leadership is, the ways in which we've defined what activism is, it can be hard to sort of picture stepping into that space knowing the people that we bring with us, the relationships that we bring with us. So I wanted to start with the premise. The premise is you're already a leader, and you may just not have been told. We know that there are lots of things in the world that could stand to be changed, right? We know that there's a lot of wrong out there in the world. And so part of what we want to do is to help make that right. And that's part of a Christian calling, right? Is to leave the world a better place than we found it, or the thing that we sing on Sunday mornings, right? The angels are not sent to do this work for us. It's our job to make the world a better place to live, to bring the world closer to the kingdom of God. So how do we do that? So I'm convinced that we can bring the world closer to the kingdom of God and make a difference, make an actual positive, tangible, visible in the world difference without simply adding to the polarization and the divisions between us and them, whoever's on your us and they're them, right? However you draw those lines, I think there are ways to do this that actually bring us together rather than separating us. Sometimes we have to step apart from each other in order to come back together. This is complicated stuff, right? But I'm convinced that we can do this not as team members, but as citizens together, as Christians together in our case. So this is a class in three movements. The first just happened. You're already a leader. You may not know it, but you are. And it's not that hard to do. So the second movement is going to be, so why aren't you leading? What is it that stands in the way of, we'll talk about it in terms of political engagement, but it's not just political engagement, right? And I'm going to draw a distinction here between political and partisan, okay? So political engagement is anything we do that has an impact on someone else. Anything we do that has an impact on someone else. Any decision that a group of people makes is politics. And we make those decisions in all different ways. Some of those are formal structural government decisions, and some of those are the way we spend our money, the way we invest our money, the way that we spend our time, the way that we nurture relationships with our neighbors. We just talked about neighbors for a long time, right? Bring those neighbors with you into this conversation. So that's politics. Politics is anything where we as a group make a decision that affects more than just one of us. Partisanship is whose team are you on? Partisanship is the question of, is the team with the D's after their name, or the R's after their name, or the L's after their name, or the G's after their name, or the different, you know, we color code and we give them mascots, and this is the NFL, right? So that's partisan, right? Partisan is, did my team win? Did the Republicans win this round? Or did the Democrats win this round? Or did Bernie Sanders win this round? Or Elizabeth Warren win this round? Or Amy Klobuchar win this round? It's that. That's partisan, right? Because it has a winner and a loser on teams. I'm going to set partisanship aside so that we can do politics, so that we can be engaged political people, which is not to say that we're even necessarily going to talk about issues today, right? We talk a lot about issues. I want to talk about how we lead in the world. So the second movement that is just, it's almost upon you, is the why aren't you leading? And sort of arena for that leadership is going to be public engagement, political engagement. And then we're going to talk about, so how do you make a difference? So how do you do that? I'm going to give you a second TED Talk. It's a little bit longer than the first one. It also speaks a little bit slower. It is also Canadian. Are all three of these Canadian? That would be fun. I'm not sure the third one is Canadian, but it might be. We'll find out. This one is also Canadian. Dave Meslin is talking about the antidote to apathy. And he's going to say apathy as we know it does not exist. Just like Drew Dudley said, you're already a leader, Meslin says, you already care, and so do other people. So why aren't we engaged? And he's going to tell us about why we're not engaged. He is a local organizer in Toronto, which is in Canada. Dave Meslin is Canadian, which is people who are in Canada. And so we're going to find out as we watch this that Canada has the same problems the United States has. So we can sound more polite about it, but they have the same problems. So here is Dave Meslin telling you why you are not apathetic.
Roger, he thinks we're from Rio Lindo.
You know, I haven't heard a funny preacher in a long time.
You're still looking for one, aren't you?
Well, often do we hear that people just don't care? How many times have you been told that real substantial change isn't possible because most people are too selfish, too stupid, or too lazy to try and make a difference in their community? I propose to you today that apathy as we think we know it doesn't actually exist, but rather that people do care, but that we live in a world that actively discourages engagement by constantly putting obstacles and barriers in our way. And I'll give you some examples of what I mean. Let's start with City Hall. You ever seen one of these before? This is a newspaper ad. It's a notice of a zoning application change for a new office building, so the neighborhood knows what's happening. As you can see, it's impossible to read. You need to get halfway down, even find out which address they're talking about, and then further down in tiny 10-point font to find out how to actually get involved. Imagine if the private sector advertised in the same way. If Nike wanted to sell a pair of shoes and put an ad in the paper like that. Now, that would never happen. You'll never see an ad like that because Nike actually wants you to buy their shoes. Whereas the City of Toronto clearly doesn't want you involved with the planning process, otherwise their ads would look something like this, with all the information basically laid out clearly. As long as the city's putting out notices like this to try and get people engaged, then of course people aren't going to be engaged. But that's not apathy, that's intentional exclusion. Public space. The manner in which we mistreat our public spaces is a huge obstacle towards any type of progressive political change because we've essentially put a price tag on freedom of expression. Whoever has the most money gets the loudest voice, dominating the visual and mental environment. The problem with this model is that there's some amazing messages that need to be said that aren't profitable to say, so you're never going to see them on a billboard. The media plays an important role in developing our relationship with political change, mainly by ignoring politics and focusing on celebrities and scandals. But even when they do talk about important political issues, they do it in a way that I feel discourages engagement. And I'll give you an example. The Now magazine from last week, Progressive Downtown Weekly in Toronto. This is the cover story. It's an article about a theater performance, and it starts with basic information about where it is, in case you actually want to go and see it after you've read the article. Where, the time, the website. Same with this. It's a movie review, a ARG review, a book review, where the reading is in case you want to go. A restaurant, you might not want to just read about it, maybe you want to go to the restaurant, so they tell you where it is, what the prices are, the address, the phone number, etc. Then you get to their political articles. Here's a great article about an important election race that's happening. Talks about the candidates, written very well, but no information, no follow-up, no websites for the campaigns, no information about when the debates are, where the campaign offices are. Here's another good article about a new campaign opposing privatization of transit without any contact information for the campaign. The message seems to be that the readers are most likely to want to eat, maybe read a book, maybe see a movie, but not be engaged in their community. And you might think this is a small thing, but I think it's important because it sets a tone and it reinforces the dangerous idea that politics is a spectator sport. Heroes, how do we view leadership? Look at these 10 movies. What do they have in common? Anyone? They all have heroes who were chosen. Someone came up to them and said, "You're the chosen one. There's a prophecy. You have to save the world." And then someone goes off and saves the world because they've been told to, with a few people tagging along. This helps me understand why a lot of people have trouble seeing themselves as leaders, because it sends all the wrong messages about what leadership is about. A heroic effort is a collective effort, number one. Number two, it's imperfect. It's not very glamorous, and it doesn't suddenly start and suddenly end. It's an ongoing process your whole life. But most importantly, it's voluntary. It's voluntary. As long as we're teaching our kids that heroism starts when someone scratches a mark on your forehead, or someone tells you that you're part of a prophecy, they're missing the most important characteristic of leadership, which is that it comes from within. It's about following your own dreams uninvited. Uninvited, and then working with others to make those dreams come true. Political parties, oh boy. Political parties could and should be one of the basic entry points for people to get engaged in politics. Instead, they've become, sadly, uninspiring and uncreative organizations that rely so heavily on market research and polling and focus groups that they end up all saying the same thing, pretty much regurgitating back to us what we already want to hear at the expense of putting forward bold and creative ideas. And people can smell that, and it feeds cynicism. charitable status. Groups who have charitable status in Canada aren't allowed to do advocacy. This is a huge problem and a huge obstacle to change because it means that some of the most passionate and informed voices are completely silenced, especially during election time. Which leads us to the last one, which is our elections. As you may have noticed, our elections in Canada are a complete joke. We use out-of-dated systems that are unfair and create random results. Canada is currently led by a party that most Canadians didn't actually want. How can we honestly and genuinely encourage more people to vote when votes don't count in Canada? And you add all this up together, and of course people are apathetic. It's like trying to run into a brick wall. Now, I'm not trying to be negative by throwing all these obstacles out and explaining all, you know, what's in our way. Quite the opposite. I actually think people are amazing and smart and that they do care. But that, as I said, we live in this environment where all these obstacles are being put in our way. As long as we believe that people, our own neighbors, are selfish, stupid, or lazy, then there's no hope. But we can change all those things I mentioned. We can open up City Hall. We can reform our electoral systems. We can democratize our public spaces. My main message is, if we can redefine apathy, not as some kind of internal syndrome, but as a complex web of cultural barriers that reinforces disengagement, and if we can clearly identify what those obstacles are, and then if we can work together collectively to dismantle those obstacles, then anything is possible. Thank you.
Roger agrees. He doesn't always, so this is a good thing. Okay, so apathy as we know it does not exist. People are not selfish and stupid and lazy. Instead, seven problems, right? He's got a book that answers the problems that he actually wrote after this TED Talk, so this was not even like, this was just the, I need to get this idea out there. So government processes discourage engagement. So you have things like the zoning notice that, what do you do with that? Public space is dominated by advertising, not by the messages that matter. The media doesn't tell us how to get involved, even when they are covering politics. We have this idea of heroes. This is the same thing Verdummy was talking about, I think maybe from that same stage. That we have this cultural narrative that leadership is one person who, you know, was sort of chosen by the fates, right, in order to stand up and be the leader, when real leadership is collective and it's imperfect and most of all it's voluntary. Political parties following public opinion rather than actually leading with solutions. Restrictions on how charities can advocate in the public sphere. The dynamics around that, I think, are slightly different between Canada and the United States, but there are rules, right? There are rules about how a nonprofit can engage politically. There may be really good reasons for those rules, right? But is that working? And elections lead to outcomes that the majority didn't want. The majority, in fact, don't even vote. So there's a whole problem all by itself, right? Yeah. So I want to allow you to identify one thing that's wrong in the world. Just one. And here's why. So this is one thing that's wrong in the world or one thing that you hope can be set right in the world. We're not going to fix it this morning. But here's why to choose one. You have to choose one so that you can actually focus on it. I'm not very good, you know the line about not seeing the forest for the trees? I'm not very good at seeing trees. This is not a thing I do all that well. I'm really good at forests. Trees are hard for me. So if nothing else, this is a thing I have to do, right? I have to focus on a thing. Now, over the course of more than 1 hour, you might focus on more than one thing. But choose one thing. Because you can't lead in every area all at once. You have to choose where you're going to lead. That's part of leadership. It's self-leadership, right? So you're all thinking of a thing. You don't even need to tell me what the thing is. Yeah. because the next question is, for that thing,
What is your biggest, again, you have to choose, what is your biggest obstacle to getting involved? And that I would be interested in hearing out loud. I don't even need to know the topic. What's the biggest obstacle for you getting involved on that?
Time.
Time. There's so much else going on and fitting the time in. Okay.
Well, if it's a global issue, how do you get in touch with other people so far removed?
Yeah. So the people with the levers are so far away. Yeah. Okay.
Not knowing the step-by-step, the sequence that I would need to do to maybe get something changed or accomplished.
Yeah. So what are sort of
a map?
Not having a map. Yeah.
So following up on that, if you decide to try something and then you run into a brick wall, mm-hmm. because of an obstacle.
Right.
So there are 14 different directions you can go from there to try mm-hmm. again. And it gets exhausting and confusing. And
yeah. So where do I go after I fail?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Something more personal, lack of self-confidence to do anything.
Yeah. Yeah. Good. So, time. Finding and making the time to do whatever it is I'm going to do on whatever this topic is, right? Do I have access to the people who actually make the difference? They're so far away. What do I do that will actually change someone? What's a step-by-step map from here to where I want to, from here to where I want to be? What do I do after I fail? Because I will, right? So what do I do? How do I get myself to attempt to, right? And how do I convince myself that I can do this? So those are all really solid, real problems, barriers to making a difference in the world. So I'm interested. I have this little parenthetical after the making a difference in the working title of this session is so making a difference and keeping your friends. And actually, I didn't hear anybody say, I'm afraid that if I try to make a difference, all my friends will turn on me. That's interesting. That was sort of in the landscape of the way the question was originally asked. I have all of these people I care about, and I'm sort of scared to step out for fear of seeming like I'm stepping against people that I care about. So you're all seeing, maybe that's also a barrier for you, but it's not actually your biggest barrier. And I would say it probably isn't realistically a barrier. There's no reason we can't speak out and make a difference and have positive relationships, even with people who disagree with us about how to solve the problem or what the problem is. So,
or have your friends say that, the issue is so large, you're not going to be able to do anything about it.
Right. And that's a piece of what I heard Anne say, that, the change makers are so far away.
Right.
Yeah. How do I make a difference on this? I think that's a piece of the time thing, too. I should say for myself, that's a piece of how the time problem falls in my lap, that it seems that all the things are so big, I don't have time to change at the big scale all these things. Yeah. There are other ways that the time problem is also there. But okay, so the thesis, again, just to remind us of that, is that we are already leaders. We are already leaders. And so
your final video for the day, and then we'll talk just a little bit before I also I'm going to share with you what we're going to do starting next week as we move into Lent. Your final video is how to do it. This is how to start a movement.
Gentlemen, at TED, we talk a lot about leadership and how to make a movement. So let's watch a movement happen, start to finish, in under 3 minutes and dissect some lessons from it. First, of course, you know, a leader needs the guts to stand out and be ridiculed. But what he's doing is so easy to follow. So here's his first follower with a crucial role. He's going to show everyone else how to follow. Now notice that the leader embraces him as an equal. So now it's not about the leader anymore, it's about them, plural. Now there he is calling to his friends. Now if you notice that the first follower is actually an underestimated form of leadership in itself. It takes guts to stand out like that. The first follower is what transforms a lone nut into a leader. And here comes a second follower. Now it's not a lone nut, it's not two nuts. Three is a crowd, and the crowd is news. So a movement must be public. It's important to show not just the leader, but the followers, because you find that new followers emulate the followers, not the leader. Now here come two more people, and immediately after, three more people. Now we've got momentum. This is the tipping point. Now we've got a movement. So, notice that as more people join in, it's less risky. So those that were sitting on the fence before now have no reason not to. They won't stand out, they won't be ridiculed, but they will be part of the in crowd if they hurry. So over the next minute, you'll see all of the those that prefer to stick with the crowd, because eventually they would be ridiculed for not joining in. And that's how you make a movement. But let's recap some lessons from this. So, first, if you are the type, like the shirtless dancing guy, that is standing alone, remember the importance of nurturing your first few followers as equals. So it's clearly about the movement, not you. Okay, but we might have missed the real lesson here. The biggest lesson, if you noticed, did you catch it? Is that leadership is over-glorified. That yes, it was the shirtless guy was first, and he'll get all the credit, but it was really the first follower that transformed the lone nut into a leader. So as we're told that we should all be leaders, that would be really ineffective. If you really care about starting a movement, have the courage to follow and show others how to follow. And when you find a lone nut doing something great, have the guts to be the first one to stand up and join in. And what a perfect place to do that, at TED. Thanks.
You didn't think you were a leader, right? But following is actually a form of leadership. Particularly the first follower, right? They're a really important person because they transform the lone nut into a leader, right? Because a leader with no followers is just a lone nut. But being that first follower, then, he pointed out, the first follower is the most important person in the movement because the first follower shows other people how to follow, and they become the one whom other people follow. So when we think about leadership with that, you know, sort of that you've been chosen by prophecy and there's a thing on your forehead, the way that we talk about leadership as this cultural heroic narrative is that we think everybody needs to be the shirtless dancing guy. We need those people, they're important. And what we really need are those first followers, right? What we really need are the ones who are willing to step into whatever that movement is, and that is leadership. Because as Drew Dudley said, you're already a leader. You just may not realize it.
So if you really care about starting a movement, this is just Derek again, if you really care about starting a movement, have the courage to follow and show others how to follow. And when you find a lone nut doing something great, have the guts to be the first one to stand up and join in. So you don't have to be a leader, leader, capital L with the quotation marks or whatever around it, to make a difference. You have to be the first follower, or the whatever follower, right? Because following a group is a lot less risky, right? As long as that group is going the direction you want to go, following that group, the direction you want to go, is actually leadership. It is actually a decision to go the direction you want to go. This is not in the videos, but I'll just set it there. To lead into the future, if you want to think future about leadership, remember, leadership is following. Leadership is following the right direction. If you want to lead into the future, typically helps to follow someone who is younger and browner and poorer than you are. Jesus was all of those. That takes stepping more consciously into that follower role for those of us who are kind of used to positions of status and leadership, right? Because we have all been in positions of leadership. And so stepping into that followership role, that's hard by itself. So decide whom you want to follow. And so here's your homework for those of you who want to make the world a better place. Find somebody who looks like they're already going the direction that you want the world to go. And follow them. Just try it. Like, figure out, hey, it looks like you're doing something that I want to see more of in the world. I don't even know what it is or how you're doing it, but it looks like it, right? You can try it, run into a wall and say, oh, I know why I don't want to follow that person anymore. I'll follow this person over here, right? But that choice of whom to follow is leadership. So there's your homework for the rest of forever. Right? Find someone going where you want the world to go and get to know them and learn how to follow them. I'm going to turn the page, so to speak, and talk about what we're going to be doing during Lent. We have fun little books for everybody. One of the questions that came to us, thank you, Roger, one of the questions, that's servant leadership right there. One of the questions that came to us was, how do I pray? And now some of you are already like thoroughly accomplished prayers and could teach this already, but the only real teacher of prayer is praying. So kind of shifting gears for Lent, it's a time to kind of change our focus and change our emphasis. I'm going to invite us to walk through listen, praying in a noisy world. This is relevant to that time thing. This is, I think, relevant to some of the ways that we've had to deal with, you know, what's our relationship to our neighbors? What's our relationship to the big issues around us? This is less of a contemporary issue in the sense of issue, but it's real contemporary, right? Because prayer should always happen. The books are invitations into daily practice of prayer. So there's an introduction that begins with the scripture reading for today's worship service, in fact. And it talks about not only why we pray, but how the book teaches us. Your assignment for the week is to read up through page 21. That's the introduction and how to use this book. And then begin the daily prayer practice. That's what the book really is. It's a daily prayer practice for 6 weeks. Or 40 days, if you're thinking Lentinally. So Lent is coming up. That's 40 days. That's a great amount of time to really kind of sink into, soak into what prayer is about.
Just a couple other pieces here. The book includes a United Methodist translation of the Lord's Prayer because the author is a United Methodist bishop. Use a translation of the Lord's Prayer that is close to your heart, which may be the translation that's in there. It may be there's other translations, right? We know that by now. So use one close to your heart. The assignment, I mean, the book is kind of structured around a daily practice of prayer. Prayer is like an antibiotic. If you miss a dose, take the next dose, right? It doesn't matter, you know, you don't lose points for, I missed Monday and now it's Tuesday and the whole thing is sunk, right? Every time you pray is part of this practice. So just resume at the next one. If you fall off the horse, I will fall off the horse, I promise you. We will talk about this on Sunday mornings. We've got videos and some discussion questions, but the discussion questions really kind of depend on at least some of us having done the homework. And the homework is practice, right? So you don't have to bring your answers back, but bring your experiences back. You may already have a regular prayer practice, right? You've all been in the church for a good long time, just looking around this room. And so you may have daily devotional and prayer practices that are already part of your life and your soul. I would invite you to consider either replacing it for these 40 days with the prayer practice that Reuben Job offers to us, or supplementing your daily prayer practice with the specific habit that he sort of invites us into each week. He gives us a different practice to really focus on. Things like silence and consciously turning over our cares to God and, you know, things that can easily be incorporated into an existing prayer practice. If you are a devotional guide reader, I am not a devotional guide reader. That's always my disclaimer. It's just not a thing that clicks for me. So it's not part of my prayer practice. If you are a devotional guide reader, that's great. And you can do that right alongside this. We provide the Daily Word devotional guides throughout the year. There is also a Lenten devotional guide from the Presbyterian Church, Becoming a Beloved Community, a Matthew 25 Journey to the Cross. And this has daily devotions for every day during Lent, so beginning this Wednesday all the way up through the day before Easter. It may even cover Easter Sunday. I didn't check. It does. So you can do this alongside the book Listen. You can do whichever other devotional guide you are already participating with. There are other approaches to structuring daily prayer. I use a daily prayer structure that comes from our Book of Common Worship, and that is not a devotional guide, and that does work for me. So there are different ways into this. But the key is to incorporate whatever that practice for the week is, because these are practices that actually invite us not just to have things to say, which I always have plenty to say, apparently, but actually invite us to listen to God, which is sort of an underdeveloped part of a lot of our prayer lives. So I said that all really quickly because I knew I was losing choir people just right and left as I started that. But I want to invite any questions y'all may have about where we're headed for Lent.
Ash Wednesday service is at 6:30.
Ash Wednesday service is at 6:30 this Wednesday, the 26th.
As a former Methodist, I think there's a possibility that this Reuben Job might have been in Iowa.
He was Bishop of Iowa for 15 years.
That name rings a bell.
Yep. So he was, a parish pastor in North Dakota, I believe, became Bishop of Iowa in
around 1980-ish, and was bishop until 92-94, something like, and then became the editor of the Upper Room. If you are, if you're an Upper Room reader, that's a, the Daily Bread. I get those confused because my...
was Upper Room.
Was it Upper Room? Okay. So one's Methodist and one's Presbyterian, and my church growing up got them both, so I don't know which one's which. So he was editor of the Upper Room for the end of his career. He passed away just a small handful of years ago. He is a much accomplished teacher of prayer and invites us to pray this way. Marilyn?
He is my step-grandmother's son.
Whoa.
Ah, we have a celebrity in our midst, yeah. Folks.
Did you?
No. If I had to guess, there would be a minister somewhere.
So this is Uncle Reuben, right?
What?
This is Uncle Reuben.
He may not acknowledge it.
Anyway, my grandmother was married after I was born, and so I didn't really know her family too much, but I do know that Reuben Joe was her son.
Look at this. So I don't think we don't get to spend a lot of time directly with Reuben Job in the videos. The videos have like ordinary people talking about prayer. So unfortunately we don't get to hear a lot of his voice aloud, but his voice is very present in the writing. And so so from one of the family, right? That's great.
I'm really happy that I'm really glad to be part of the Presbyterian tradition, because I think we have always embraced a wealth of ideas and opinions. And I feel really comfortable that you can attend and be part of the faith without feeling like you're ostracized or you're doing something wrong.
Yeah.
And I really like the fact that the windows with the Presbyterian logo are on both sides of the congregation, which sets up kind of like a continuum. Mm-hmm. And you can put yourself anywhere on that, you know?
Right.
As opposed to the rap that evangelical churches get, that you better conform and you better vote here and you better toe the line.
Yeah, I don't like to put people in boxes.
No, and I don't think Presbyterians do. I mean, it was from Angela Davis to, you know, there's been a
right.
whole mess of different leaders.
Right.
And they've all been able to stay within the tradition.
Right.
Have they not? Or am I...
Well, it's not exactly our history, but I like what you're saying.
Yeah, so we have failed at this, for sure, from time to time, let's say.
Yeah.
But we do believe that all truth is God's truth. Right? So if someone is speaking truth, even if they're a Methodist, right, we will still understand that to be truth. Now, there are points at which the Presbyterian tradition and the United Methodist tradition sharply disagree with each other. And that is good too, right? That is another place where we can both get a better sense of what truth is. Because if we pretended it didn't matter what people think, then what's the point in trying to figure out what the truth is, right? But we can easily look at, even though their translation of the Lord's Prayer is wrong, we can easily look at what Uncle Reuben says and say, yeah, there is real truth and value in this. So
has there been an issue since slavery that as moving towards splitting the Presbyterian Church, or are we incorporating ideas and accepting differences?
So I'm looking at, after Easter, one of the other sets of questions that came up was kind of, where is this whole religion thing headed in the future? And probably to understand where this whole religion thing is headed in the future, it would probably help us to look at what it's been up to for the last couple hundred years.
So I will jot down that question of what are the issues that have divided us since slavery, because we did know about that one, right? We structurally, institutionally split over slavery, and it only took us 130 years to come back together.
Where I was in Arizona, they had a Presbyterian church there, but it was not PCUSA. It was an E, Evangelical Presbyterian Church. And what I want to say is that I'm more proud of the PCUSA today than ever because it's inclusive. E is still a little bit exclusive in that it really has this thing about women not being in the pulpit. Oh,
no, my brother-in-law ran into that.
Okay, and the only confession that they will espouse to is the Westminster Confession of Faith, which was back in the 17th century. So I'm saddened by the splits.
That might be an interesting learning out a lesson, but I know there's a Cumberland Presbyterian Church.
Yes,
church.
Yeah. That's a rich, rich tradition of our Presbyterian faith. Okay. Very much involved in medical mission.
Oh, Cumberland Presbyterian Church? It was East Tennessee, so we were quote Northern Presbyterian, whatever that was. And so at some point in the civil rights movement, we were going. So yeah. Our church in our small town became two churches, you know.
Right.
Very traumatic. So.
Yeah. So I might do a little Presbyterian history as one of the beginning of those future of religion courses, because that having a sense of how we got to where we are will give us a sense of where we might be headed in the midst of kind of the bottom falling out of institutional religion in North America anyway.
And in the midst of polarization in society in general.
Right.
I mean, it's commonly recognized that that's an mm-hmm. issue.
Right.
Culturally, so, how do we fit in there?
So this is good. This gives me like 7 weeks to figure out what to say about all that. So, which I haven't gotten there yet, but so we are going to talk about Listen, Praying in a Noisy World next week, and so read that introduction and how to use this book, and then begin that week one practice tomorrow.
Are these ours to keep, or you want them?
These are, just like the others, they were purchased by the Kim Severson Endowment. My direction on that is if that is a valuable resource for you to keep, you are welcome to keep it, and if it's something you would rather return to the church library, we will hang on to it there.
Okay.
So.
Thank you for listening. Learn more about our mission at wdmcovenant.org.